We continue with the reading. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge while all these people stand around you from morning till evening?" Moses answered him, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it's brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and instructions." Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you are doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them his decrees and instructions and show them the way they are to live and how they are to behave. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter because they will share it with you. And if you do this and God commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied." Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. He chose capable men from all Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. They served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided themselves. Then Moses sent his father-in-law on his way, and Jethro returned to his own country.
Well, as we go to our first slide, if you are joining us for the first time, you've heard we're in the book of Exodus, and we're looking at this as our salvation story, not just the salvation story of Israel, but our salvation story. We've seen how it has framed Jesus' life and ministry, and as his followers, it frames our life as well. And today we, I'm having some difficulties with our clicker. That's okay, we'll just give it a second, and if not, I'll get you to run through those on my own or on your own. Okay, all right. Nothing yet. Can I just tell you to next slide? Go to the next slide, thanks. So we are in this testing section of the book. So from the time that Israel goes through the Red Sea and the waters close in on the Egyptian army and they are safe and they sing this salvation song, they're now on their way to Mount Sinai. And just letting you know that Rob will be preaching on that next week on Exodus 19 and 20 and another one of the really big events. So in the middle of that is this section where God keeps testing Israel. And Israel mostly fails, although there are some bright spots. And they sort of get tested and they fail in a number of different ways. And so if we can just go to our next slide. These are some of the things that they have faced along the way. So they face the issue of hunger and God provides manna, bread from heaven. They are thirsty and God causes water to flow out of a rock. They are attacked from some of their enemies, and God miraculously gives them the strength to overcome. And one of the things that you might wonder about is, well, why is God doing this in the first place? And it's a really important question to ask. If we can just go to our next slide. There is a word that is used in the Bible, a fancy word called sanctification. It's just really about the way that God trains us and matures us to become the people that he wants us to be. In the same way, if you want to play piano, you've got to do your practice. If you want to become an athlete, you've got to train yourself. If you want to become a student, you've got to study. God is always in the process of training us, and training is not easy. If you've ever had to go through training for anything, it's challenging, and that's the whole point. And there's a passage in the New Testament where Paul writes to Timothy that physical training is of some benefit or of a little value, but godliness, training towards godliness, to spiritual maturity, that's the kind of training that can bear spiritual fruit. So if you do have to become a student and study for HSC, or if you have to become an apprentice and learn your job, or if you're going to become an athlete or a musician and you have to go through these sort of temporary types of training, and you know that that's challenging, if God's going to train you, what, for spiritual maturity, to make you godly and Christ-like, it's going to take work. There's going to be hurdles. There's going to be obstacles along the way. It's going to be hard, but you're not going to become godly without the challenges, and that's the whole point. And this is what God is doing here. He's not just sending these random challenges to his people just to be annoying. He's doing this to say, are you going to trust in me? Are you going to believe that I am your God? Are you going to see that I have a plan and purpose for you? And so if we go to our next slide, one of the things, and I'm just doing a brief foreshadowing to next week, God's whole purpose in this whole Exodus thing is that he wants to develop his people to become a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So please understand this. If you haven't understood up to this point, the point of Exodus is not to get Israel out of Egypt. It's not just an exit. The point of Exodus is not just to get them out of Egypt and then into their own promised land. It's not just go from point A to point B. It's about what God wants to do and develop in these people along the way. And that's why we've said it's about our salvation journey. God didn't just save you so that you could say, I'm saved. He didn't just save you so that one day you can go to heaven. He saved you so that you could become godly and Christ-like and to become the person that he created you to be, and that collectively we would become the people that God created us to be. And that's not going to happen in our lifetime, but he's working us. There's the old Christmas carol, fit us for heaven to live with you there. He is helping us, he's maturing us and fitting us for heaven to live as the people of God. So just so you know, when Jesus once was speaking to his followers, you know, in Jerusalem, and he said, you were a city built on a hill to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. He said, why do you think that I put you, this little group of people, in the center of, you know, Israel today is still called the middle of the earth. The center of everything. It's the middle of the Middle East. It's the trade route. It's kind of where everything centers. It's all over the news today. What happens there? Everyone is watching very closely. I put this little nation there, and I put you up on top of the hill so that as people are sort of traveling through, they look up and they see this city set on the hill that is meant to be a light to the world, but not just a physical light, a spiritual light. All these pagan people worshiping me in their own pagan gods and living in their own way, they should be able to look to you to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That's the goal. That's the goal of the whole Exodus. And it's just going to take them a little bit of time to get there. But as Moses said later in Leviticus, be holy because I, your God, am holy. I think we're back with the clicker. And so in the middle of all of this testing, we come to this really unusual section. And I'm really glad when I go and refer sometimes to Bible commentaries and I look to see what other preachers have said, it's always a relief when you go, this is a really weird story. And then you read all of these other scholars and they go, this is a really weird story. And it's a really weird story because we're now only one chapter away from what is the center and arguably the highlight of the whole book, We're getting ready to go to Mount Sinai. God's going to appear to Moses. He's going to give these people his law. He's going to give them a priesthood. He's going to develop all of these things to help them become a kingdom of priests. But just before that happens, Moses finds himself, first of all, we realize that he's in a broken family. We don't think that about Moses, but Moses has had a family breakdown. And his father-in-law says, I'm bringing your family back to you. You're going to need them and they need you. And you realize this prophet, just like everyone else, has come from a broken marriage and a broken family. And then secondly, you're going to realize that Moses is trying to do something that's impossible for him. They have no government. And it's going to be this pagan Midianite priest who's going to come to him and say, what you're doing is no good. So before he even meets with God on Mount Sinai, this pagan foreign priest is going to come to him, bring his family back, worship his God, and then watch what he's doing and give Moses, who is arguably the greatest prophet in the Old Testament, he's going to give him advice. And Moses is going to take it and he's going to follow it. It's like the story of Mary Magdalene going to the tomb. You would never go and put an ex-demon-possessed woman to be the witness of Christ's resurrection unless it was true. If you're trying to write a story that was believable, then have a whole bunch of people who are credible. Don't take an ex-demon-possessed crazy woman and leave her there to be the witness to the resurrection and then say, go and tell the disciples what you have seen. You would write it the other way around. And unless this story is true, and if it's the way that it actually unfolded, it's the only reason that you would write it this way. And so God is doing something really interesting here. And I just want to say that this is a story that is deeply personal, and it's got some value there, but it's also huge in its scope. And when we heard today about other nations and people and languages coming to know God, it's got God's worldwide mission in focus. And so first of all, I want to talk a little bit about the personal side of it. And I want to just say to you that whether you're talking about the Old Testament or the New Testament or the modern day church, there is a huge cost paid by Christian workers, whether they're called pastors or missionaries or leaders. And it's something that we don't talk about enough. But God has sort of plunked this story there, and there isn't much way of going around it. So I want to talk a little bit about this figure, Zipporah, who we meet. This is Moses' wife. You don't hear a lot about her. She's not a major figure in the Old Testament. But there are a few highlights which you can see up there on the screen. So first of all, we know that when Moses went out to go and help Jethro with his flock. It's ironic now that Jethro is going to come back and help Moses with his flock. But he meets Jethro, and he meets Jethro's daughter Zipporah, and he marries her. And then we find out that they have their first son. And they name him Gershon, which means foreigner in a foreign land. Now that may just go right past us for a moment, but I just want to, especially if you are a younger person sitting here, back in the early 90s, there was a band called Radiohead, and they wrote a song that still gets played quite a bit. It's called Creep, and it's quite a melancholy song, but the words are basically, I'm a creep, I'm a weirdo, what am I doing here, I don't belong here. It became an anthem for a whole bunch of rejected people in the world saying, who am I? Where am I? What am I doing here? I don't belong. I want you to know that what the scriptures are declaring is that Moses was the original creep, long before Radiohead. He got put in a basket by his own mother, floated down a river, gets adopted by an Egyptian family, grows up, goes back to try to help his own people. They reject him. He kills an Egyptian. He has to go and flee out into the wilderness. He becomes a foreigner in a foreign land with a foreign woman. He names his child Foreigner. He names his child Creep, Weirdo. Then he goes back to try to go and free his own people, and his own people reject him again. They want to stone him to death, and he spends most of his day, in fact, from sunrise to sunset, sitting there amongst this group of people who complain to him all day long. I'm a creep. I'm a weirdo. What am I doing here? I don't belong here. And this has an impact on his family. And you hear about it in chapter 4 of Exodus, because there's this weird little story, and after this story, Zipporah disappears. But God had designed it so that his people were supposed to bear the mark of circumcision. It would have been a little bit like baptism, but it was a bit more personal than that, because the whole idea is when Israelites went to procreate, a woman wasn't going to procreate with someone unless he had the mark of the covenant of God. And that's one way that you make sure that everyone who is part of the family of God is actually part of the family of God, because you're only marrying someone who has this sign. And Zipporah hears about this and she goes, this is really weird. You want me to circumcise my son? What is this weird blood religion that you have brought me into? And it's a confronting story. She goes and she circumcises her son, takes the bloody foreskin and throws it down at Moses' feet and says, you are a bridegroom of blood to me. Don't think that this stuff is not hard on families. This is tough. And Zipporah disappears. And then you only hear about her again when in chapter 18 she reemerges and Jethro says, I am coming to you and I'm bringing back your family. Now, some people like to try to be polite and nice to Moses, and oh, he was a nice guy. He wouldn't have sent her away, even though it says he sent her away. Maybe he just was trying to keep her safe. Can you imagine being the prophet and telling all of these men, women, and children, young and old, I'm going to deliver you and trust God, but I'm sending my family back to the father-in-law because I want to keep them safe? It would be a completely contrary message. That's not why he sent her away. The word is, he sent her away. They had a falling out, and they are a broken family. And it doesn't say that Moses called for his family now that they were safe. It says that Jethro came out and says, I'm coming to you, and I'm bringing your family. They're going to need you, and you are going to need them. So this is a deeply personal thing. And again, I just want to go over to Paul's words to Timothy, because he makes this comment, if anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? And you can kind of hear that sort of, those sort of words foreshadow and echoing. If Moses is going to lead God's family, well, then he probably needs to know how to take care of his own family as well. And it's Jethro who's the one who realizes this. And so I just wanted to make a brief comment to you, and I want you to know that I'm the power of this for me is that I'm not making any sort of veiled comments or personal comments. I just want to speak to you as a pastor generally. When Parissa and I were at the induction service in my last church 10 years ago, the guy who spoke to us, spoke at my induction service, got up and spoke, and he said, I want to read out some statistics that all of you need to know about Chad and about people who are pastors. And he read out all these dreadful statistics about the number of shipwrecked pastors and shipwrecked families and the statistically how likely you are to be able to carry on in ministry, what it will do to your family, what it will do to Christian marriages. And it was just very, very sobering stuff. And you can read about this stuff. It is a high-cost job, and it impacts families very, very deeply. And so he just said, you know, if you're going to take this guy on, you better make sure that you pray for him. And throughout our marriage, Bruce and I know we have watched the cost of it. One of the things that you get to see as a pastor, because I grew up in a pastor's family, is that you get to see the underbelly of the church, okay? So there's the church that meets here on Sunday. You're all dressed very nicely. You're smiling. You're going to go and have a cup of coffee together. Then there's the church that meets before Moses and complains day and night from sunrise to sunset. I've known that family since I was a child. My dad brought those things home from the time I was a little kid. I watched that. I watched Mom and Dad fighting in the car all the way to church, and then Dad getting up and doing the announcements and prayers and sermon. I watched all of that kind of stuff, and it's really hard. It's very hard on families, and it's hard on missionaries, and it's hard on church leaders. And I know that we complain about our leaders. It's part of Western culture. It's part of Aussie culture. You know, as soon as someone gets into, you know, prime minister, then you, it's free game. You can complain about them. But someone once said to me, but it's more personal when you are a pastor or a church leader because it's your family. If you're a politician, you expect the opposition to complain about you. But when you're a pastor and a church leader, it's your family. And the complaining and the grumbling and all of that, it just has an impact. And you take it home with you every single day and take it home with you every single night. And I just wanted to, as my own personal little interjection, I just want to say a huge thank you to my wife, who has stuck with me throughout more than 30 years of pastoral ministry. And if you want to know what having an Adam and Eve partnership looks like in ministry, it's not that I go off to work and then there's dinner cooked when I get home or the laundry is done. Parissa and I have always said, I'm there to sort of teach and explain the Word of God. God brought Parissa into my life to teach me about the heart of God. I wouldn't know what Jesus' heart is like unless I met Parissa. And I know more about Jesus now through Parissa than all the conferences, all the books, everything that I have ever read, every sermon I've ever heard. I know more from watching my wife what the heart of Jesus looks like than anything else. And I just want to say thank you. And I just want to say thank you because I wouldn't be here in ministry if I didn't have this woman at my side. I just wouldn't have kept going. It's been her, and she's kept me going through that time. And I just wanted to say thank you, and I just wanted to remind us we need to pray for all of our church leaders, our missionaries, our pastors, our elders, and everyone else. The second thing I want to bring out here is Jethro's spiritual response. Moses gives a testimony. He shares with Jethro, because remember, there's no internet, there's no phone, all this stuff has been happening. There's probably rumors spreading around all throughout the ancient world. But now Moses says, let me tell you firsthand what has happened here. And so Moses told his father-in-law about everything that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and about the hardships they had met along the way and how the Lord had saved and helped them. And Jethro was delighted to hear about the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hands of the Egyptians. Let me just remind you that it was Midianites who sold Joseph into slavery down in Egypt in the first place. When Ross spoke to us from Judges, it was the Midianites who were attacking Israel. They were sworn enemies. This is not a friendly nation. This is an enemy nation. And now this Midianite priest hears Moses' testimony about what God has done. And not only does he hear it and say, that's really good, he says, praise be to the Lord who rescued you from the hands of the Egyptians and Pharaoh and rescued the people from the hands of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods. For he did this to those who had treated Israel arrogantly. And then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices and offered them to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses. You know, when David was telling you about the democracy sausages and getting snagged and God, you know, how God brought him in to this church family, this is the moment that Jethro, this pagan Midianite priest, is brought into the family of God. It's a huge thing. And this is just a little table that kind of reminds us that throughout Israel's history, from the time of Abraham, he just keeps on bringing in these foreign people and grafting them into a family. And so it reminds us a little bit about the story of Ruth, when this pagan foreigner says to her mother-in-law, Naomi, your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Or the way that a guy by the name of Melchizedek, this foreign priest, comes in and declares who God is, and is given this accolade as a type of Christ, a type of thing to come. God just keeps bringing in, while he's focused on Israel, he just keeps on bringing in these foreign nations, and we get a chance to see it in the case of Jethro, because God had said to Abraham, all the people on earth will be blessed through you. And now we're getting a chance for the Midianites to have a look in. And then you get to this key part of the whole thing, that Jethro is going to give advice. And this is not just the kind of advice that in-laws give to you. You know, we've all received that kind of advice. But you realize that God is in this. You know, that the next day Moses took his seat to serve as judge, and the people stood around him from morning until evening, from sun up to sundown. And his father-in-law asked him about what's going on, and then he says, what you are doing is not good. You and these people who came to you will wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you, and you cannot handle it alone. Now listen to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. In other words, he's not just saying, now we've done all the religious stuff. He's saying, this is stuff that God wants you to hear. And then he says this interesting thing. You must be the people's representative before God, and you bring their disputes to him. Teach them his decrees and instructions, and show them the way that they are to live and behave. In other words, go and train up some people and then teach them so that they can teach others, and then you can make the load lighter for yourself. So again, in Paul's letter to Timothy, he says, the things that you've heard me say, Timothy, in the presence of witnesses, I want you to entrust these things to faithful men who will then be able to teach others. Hundreds of years before Paul writes these things to Timothy, it's the exact same advice that God, through his Holy Spirit, is given to this pagan Midianite priest to give to Moses. And Moses implements it. And so this challenge of government out in the wilderness, where people are on the verge of stoning Moses to death and they're getting tired and worn out, it is because Moses listens to the advice of this foreigner that they are saved from this challenge. Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. And therefore, before God actually establishes his law and his priesthood and all the things that you're going to hear about next week, God brings this instruction through a Midianite priest. And then we're told that he goes back home to his own people. The thing that we call the Great Commission, which Christ has given to us, is that we are to go and make disciples of all people. And how do we do that? We baptize them, as some of you might be in November, but then we teach them to obey everything that we were taught, all the way up to go make disciples and baptize them and teach them to obey everything that I have taught you, which includes go make disciples and train them and teach them. And it's this cycle, and as we keep doing it, the church keeps growing. It's part of Paul's word to Timothy. It's part of Christ's Great Commission. And therefore, the final thing that I want to say to you today is that there is this great challenge. Can we listen to the advice of foreigners? I wish I had a whole sermon to preach on this, but I don't. So in just a couple of minutes, I want to say that if you looked at missionary history over the last couple of centuries, all the great missionaries are, you know, white men, right? You're going to have your William Careys, you're going to have your Billy Graham, the evangelist. And the centers of evangelism are, of course, North America, and they're England, and it's Western Europe, and that's where all the missionary forces have come from. If you're not aware, I need you to be aware, all of that is changing. It is changing radically. It is changing before our eyes. Now people use the term the Global South, which either means everything kind of south of North America and the northern hemisphere of Europe. And the missionary movement and church growth movement has shifted down into Africa. It has shifted down into Asia. It has shifted down into South America. While the churches are slowly on the decline throughout North America and throughout Western countries, Christianity is on the rise throughout Southern Africa, throughout China, throughout Southeast Asia, throughout South America. And the prediction is in the next 10 years, the missionary force of the world is not going to come from North America, it's not going to come from Australia, it's not going to come from England, it's not going to come from France, it's going to come from Africa. They are already sending their missionaries into the ghettos and slums throughout North America. The Chinese missionaries already have their eyes set on completing the task to go back into the Middle East because Westerners can't get in there, but Chinese people can. And the growing missionary force of the world is coming out of South America, it's coming out of Africa, and it's coming out of Asia. If we want to be effective in missions, we need to listen to the foreigners because they're the ones doing the best work. Christianity has become very tainted and is seen as a white man's Western religion, and it's very hard for Westerners to open the doors to these countries. But they're listening to those from South America, they're listening to those from India, they're listening to those from Asia. And their ears prick up when suddenly they hear the people from deep, dark Africa proclaiming the good news of God, just as Jethro did. I hope that we, like Moses, have the wisdom to listen to our brothers and sisters that we might consider to be foreigners, because they are the future of the mission. We're going to have a chance to sing in response to this, and we're going to have a chance to share in communion together.